Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. And this is one of my youngest guests ever. But and you'd say, oh, so it's a, we're going to interview a student like in education. No, he's a celebrity. He's really he's a mover and shaker. I want to welcome the program Jackson Brundage from Run Tree Hill and See Dad Run. Jackson, thanks for calling, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, fantastic. Tell our audience a little bit about your background. Then we'll go into specifically your the characters that you're playing right now. Tell us how basically you broke into acting and where you are today.
Well, I got into acting when I was about 5 years old, and I started with commercials and all the normal stuff, and then I got an episode of Las Vegas with Josh Duhamel. But I did an episode of that, and that was pretty cool. And then, I don't know, maybe a couple months later, I got One Tree Hill, and then I was on that for 5 years. And that was just amazing, all the people and everything, and being in North Carolina on the East Coast was so awesome. And then now I have See Dad Run, and we're on our second season, and it's just everything's going really good and smooth.
Well, I'm sure you are, and you're excited about it, especially we'll talk about the Kids' Choice Awards and the experience of being on this. And but first of all, a question. Now, your friends at school, are they jealous of you because of your success?
No, most of my friends at school, they just, like, whenever I see them, they normally just say, hey, I saw your episode. You were really funny in that. Good job. And it's not really a whole jealousy thing. It's just like they're really cool with it and they think of it as a normal thing, so that's pretty awesome.
Alright, let's talk about your character first of all. You said so One Tree Hill has ended, but what was your character in that on that show?
My character was Jason Scott, and he was the son of Nathan and Haley, the two main characters. And Jamie, he was just he's just a fun-loving little kid. He likes to play sports. He likes to run around and be funny, and that's what I like to do. I love to play sports and stuff like that. So we were really similar.
Cool. And did you learn a lot from that first acting experience, especially a big role like you had for so many years on One Tree Hill? That really kind of prepared you for where you are today, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Who would you say were your best influences on the set at One Tree Hill? Who would you say helped you the most as an actor?
Probably James Lafferty, who played my dad on the show, played Nathan. He was so fun to hang around with, and he was so motivating when he was acting, and me and him were in a scene. They were a good kid.
Okay, cool. And I guess from that process of going on that show, it prepared you for this great opportunity and I guess the second season of See Dad Run, and that's what you're promoting today. When you first got this gig, were you excited about the storyline and what being on the station that you're on?
Oh, yeah, the storyline was so funny, and being on Nickelodeon is one of my favorite channels. I watch Nickelodeon, like, all day. And so being on Nickelodeon and the storyline, it was just the best storyline. It could have been.
So let's learn about the character, and especially when I saw Scott Baio's part of this cast, so that's quite interesting. Tell us a little bit about your character and what you do on the show.
Well, my character, Joe Hobbs, he's very weird. He likes school. He's really smart. He's not up at all, which is very different from me, but he likes to keep to himself. He doesn't really have much fun, but that makes it funny because he's so weird, and he just keeps to himself, and he's in his own little bubble.
And so that's direct opposite. What do you like at school?
What do I like in school?
No, what do you like in school? How do you act in school compared to your character?
Oh, well, I love sports. I love to play around and get all sweaty, and I'm really smart, too. I would say I was smart, but I got on I got on the Dean's Honors List for my school, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. But, yeah, Joe, she's not athletic, and I love sports. I love basketball and football. And so we're very different, and me and Jamie Scott were really similar, so it's kind of cool.
Cool. And I guess, again, being on this show and especially the second season, you're very excited because of the role you have playing in this and especially your favorite station. Who are you learning most from in this on this set? Who would you say is your mentor as an actor on this set? Who would you say is helping you the most out to prepare?
Probably Rami Youssef, who plays Kevin, David's assistant. He's really funny. He jokes around, and that's what basically everybody does when we're during rehearsal. We just like to do our own thing. But yeah, Rami, he's so cool and nice. He gets nicknamed Chip, which is really cool. But yeah, he's just so fun, and we always play around and stuff like that. So he's really cool.
That's cool. And I guess when you shoot, is it a certain season, that, like a certain time period where you're always on the set? Where you for the show, is it like, and then do you leave school for that time, or are you able to go to school while you're filming as well?
Yeah, whenever I'm not in a couple scenes, we'll go back to school, and then we'll school for as long as we can. If it's normally we try to get 20 minutes because that counts towards our school, but if we get under 20 minutes, then it doesn't really count. But, yeah, we try to do as much school as we can when I'm not in those things. So we try to work it out as best we can.
How far is the set from your school?
It's only about like 20 minutes. So it's pretty close.
Are there any other celebrity actors at your school that you attend? Anybody else that works in the business?
No, it's just Ryan Newman, who plays my older sister, Emily, and then Bailey, who plays Jamie on the show. She's in the other room. So it's an office of trip rooms. It's me and Ryan in one room with our teacher, and Bailey in another room with her teacher. So it's just the three of us.
Okay, cool. All right, tell us a little bit about, I guess, the experience of going to the Kids' Choice Awards. Was that a really fun time?
Oh, the Kids' Choice Awards were so awesome. I went the year before, and the year before was amazing. The Kids' Choice Awards were so cool because we got to be on camera and we got to do our own thing, and that stuff like that. But it was just, it was so cool. All the people that got signed and all the performances were really awesome.
And who was your favorite to meet at the event? Everyone has their favorite person that maybe they never met before that they got to meet. Who was your favorite?
I met and took a picture with Kristen Stewart, which was really awesome.
So you were excited about that for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you see yourself as an actor, especially, you know, with the show now, but where do you see yourself wanting to do movies as well at one point in time?
Oh, yeah, I would love to do a movie, probably like a comedy action movie, because I like to do my own stunts, because I did my own stunts on One Tree Hill. And so kind of like a comedy action, like maybe cool.
So what does your mom think of you saying you like to do your own stunts? Does she like hearing that, or she rather have a stunt person doing it when you're talking about an action movie and doing your own stunts?
Well, I mean, she's okay with it as long as there's a lot of safety, like a lot of paths and stuff. But it's not really like big stunts, like jumping off buildings and stuff. It's just normal, like say falling down stairs or something like that. That's just normal. If I put on a bunch of pads and there's a pad at the end of the stairs and stuff like that, so it's not really too big.
And do you attend? Do you have acting classes? Are you constantly taking acting classes as well during your time working on CDAD?
No, I don't really take acting classes. Normally, I work with my acting coach whenever I go out on an audition or something. But no, like straight acting.
So that's cool, because I guess getting the experience of being on a big show like See Dad Run, you have the opportunity to practice a lot, and in especially the different things. So movies, all the different things. Where do you see this show going? Do you see See Dad Run having a long run, just like One Tree or Run Tree Hill? What are you thinking about that?
I think See Dad Run will go for at least 4 or 5 seasons. I think it'll go pretty far. I think it'll do really good. The rates are getting higher and higher each time. So I think it's going to be a pretty popular show.
And so that's awesome. And thinking about when you were talking about your career, where do you see yourself in 10 years as an actor? In 10 years, especially, you know, the stories of child actors, I'm sure you already are hearing about it. I'm sure your parents are already telling you, make sure that you keep, understand that not everyone works all the time. So that what is your game plan to make sure that you can go from a child actor to an adult actor and still continue to work in the business and be successful? What is your game plan so far? Do you have any ideas?
Well, in 10 years, I see myself finished with college and done with college, maybe getting some movie deals and stuff like that. So finishing my education, which is always good, and hopefully getting a couple movie deals, which would be pretty cool.
Well, and I'm sure that your agent's already working on that, right? Especially if things continue to go the way they go. And I think a lot of times Nickelodeon does spinoffs, don't they? Take a syndicated show and say, you know what, maybe we can have them in a movie as well, right? That you see that all the time, don't you?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
All the time. And so I guess soon you'll be going to school. What is your focus on now? Especially, you know, you have a radio interview. You're up pretty early in the morning. Your normal routine every day. Is it like every other kid? Because I'm sure kids are asking that, saying, okay, Jackson, are you a normal kid in the morning, getting up, maybe complaining to mom, saying, I don't really want to get up in the morning, or are you really become disciplined in this field so far?
Well, we've kind of gotten it into the routine, so waking up is not really a problem. Waking up, having breakfast, and then drop my brother off at school, and then we're on the road. The studios, and basically right as I get there, I hop into school for maybe about an hour or hour and a half-ish, and so it's just kind of gotten into a daily routine for us.
And is it weird when you're seen out in public and people know who you are? Is that strange? How are you getting used to that, where they say, oh, they're...
So weird now, because it's been happening for a while that I get recognized, like, outside and wherever I go. But, I'll get recognized, like, basically anywhere. Like, I'll get recognized at the pool one time when I'm, like, swimming in the pool, and then I'll get recognized at the mall and stuff like that. And so I'll get recognized everywhere, but it's kind of died down, which is really good, because it used to be, like, on One Tree Hill, it used to be, like, an everyday thing that I would get recognized. But it's kind of died down since I've gotten this new show, but hopefully we get more fans and it picks up again, so...
Well, you definitely, I'm sure, especially with the cast and everything in the second season, again, people that you have One Tree Hill has all different audiences watching, while Nickelodeon has a certain audience, your audience, your favorite thing. So, Jackson, where can people find more information on you, learn more about See Dad Run, and more what you do? Where do you have a Twitter, or do you have a Facebook for people to kind of follow you, or do you have a website to check things out?
I don't have a website. I don't have a Twitter or Facebook or anything. But if they want to learn more about the show, they can go to nick.com and go into the See Dad Run file, I guess, and read all about See Dad Run and read the storyline and stuff. And make sure to watch it Sundays at 8.
All right, everyone should check it out. I'll make sure that my little girl, who's 7, will watch it and remember about it and say, hey, look, I interviewed Jackson. So, Jackson, thanks for coming on the show. Love to have you back in a couple months to give us an update of other projects you have going on or to talk more about C-Dad Run. So thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. All right, you're listening to the Total Education Celebrity Show. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Very, very interesting guest I have on the line, and she's a triathlete and much, much more, and she had an experience on MTV Made, and I found out she's always in Pittsburgh. So I want to welcome the program, Kim Schwauenbauer. Kim, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having me, Neil. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to be here today.
Oh, I'm excited as well. And for what I want, for first of all, to find out is a little bit about your background. Then we'll get into, I guess, your whole promotion of making sure that people are living healthy lifestyles.
That's correct. I work on that in my business, my actual day-to-day business, and then also with my own lifestyle as a triathlete as well. So I'm really based around that whole aspect of mind, body, spirit, and really just total health.
All right. Well, fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you started, how you became a triathlete, and we'll go from there.
Sounds good. I'd be happy to. So when I was in college, I actually ended up running for Penn State. I walked on to the cross-country and track team there as a sophomore and loved my experience. Ended up graduating a team captain, which was really fun. Traveled all over the world. And once I was done with college, I thought, well, I guess this is it, because now I can't compete as a team member, so I suppose I'd have to be done with this unless I'm going to just run some marathons. So I did that for a while and realized that I was just a little bored with running, and so I thought to myself, maybe I'll try a triathlon, even though I don't know how to swim, which usually is important if you're going to actually do a triathlon, because that's the first leg of a triathlon. It's swim, bike, and then run. And so I showed up to the Moraine State Park triathlon not really knowing how to do anything but breaststroke, and ended up making it through my first triathlon swim last out of the water, mind you. And so I kept going and really worked hard on the bike and ended up getting to my strength, which was running, competed, and passed everybody on the run, all the other women, and ended up coming in first. So it was a really fun experience for me, and I thought, maybe I could be good at this. Over the next 4 or 5 years, I just kept competing hard and also started my own nutrition counseling and coaching business to coach other triathletes as well. And so now I'm really truly, you know, getting to work with what I love every day, which is helping people with nutrition and a healthier lifestyle. And at the same time, I'm competing now as a professional triathlete. Just as of last year, I got my professional card. So now I'm one competing with the best in the sport, and I love it.
So it was very surprising to you that, I guess, the growth of deciding I'm just going to do this triathlete thing to becoming a professional in this. So what are your ultimate goals as a professional triathlete?
My ultimate goals as a pro are really just to see how good I can get. I just wanted to really have this experience at the very top level echelon of our sport, and I needed to see sort of what it took to be at this level. I thought if I ever coached someone else at this level, this would be an important step in my own development as a coach. And so it's just really just to see, you know, how far I can take it over a 2 or 3 year period. I probably won't do it forever. It's the level of sacrifice is just too great. So I probably won't do it for 10 years plus, and the body won't hold up for that long, trust me.
And so you're traveling all over the country to do these professional competitions then, correct?
Yeah, even out of the country. I was just in San Juan for my last race in Puerto Rico. So even though, you know, Commonwealth, but yes, all over the place. I travel internationally if necessary.
Is this an Olympic sport as well, what you're competing in?
That is a very good question, and it's something that most people don't understand, in that there are sort of two realms of triathlon. One realm is the type that's in the Olympics, which is called ITU, International Triathlon Union is what that stands for. And those athletes actually are doing a shorter distance, and they actually can draft on the bike. So that on the bike, they're able to be very close to one another. They're able to utilize that little space behind the other person's bike to be able to go faster, and it's a very tactical race. And they run They swim about a mile, they bike about 25 miles, and then they run a 10K or 6 miles, whereas what I'm doing is considered non-drafting. So each of our individual races, we cannot be even remotely close to each other on the bike. It's a very individual sport, and I do the longer distance triathlon, so I do anywhere from 70 miles to 140.6 miles. So my races are much longer. But, yes, there is an Olympic sport for triathlon, and it's those short ITU people.
And for your sport, what is the ultimate goal in your sport, to win meets, or is it more to be ranked number one in the world? What is, I guess, the big prize for doing this?
Honestly, the big prize for everyone, you know, the Super Bowl of triathlon is truly the Ironman, which is what most people recognize on TV as being in Hawaii, and that's sort of the biggest race that they know about. And they don't even realize that there are other Ironmans all over the world, everywhere from South Africa to Arizona to, you know, where I'm going next month in Texas. There's a lot of Ironman races, but Hawaii is the Super Bowl. They only let 25 women pros into that race, 25 to 35, somewhere in there in the world. And then men, they'll let about 50 men professionals into that race based on your rankings going into that race. So you have to be good enough to get there, and then once you get there, hopefully to perform well. So not everyone will actually make it to that particular race as well. So I'd love to get to Hawaii either this year or next year, and I'd love to be able to compete at that particular level. So just to see how good I can get.
So do you have a good chance of competing in the Ironman?
That's a good question. Right now I'm sitting at about 74th place, so I need to be top 35 point-wise to be able to make it there, but the season is still young. I still have at least 4 to 5 races before they'll take their final group in August to Hawaii, so I'll be able to see how my points will match up to everyone else at that time.
So being a professional, Kim, and I'm sorry if I cut you off, being a professional, can you tell me specifically do you make money doing these events, or is it more about getting to the Ironman, or it's more about just going to these events and being healthy and training and have the competition, or is it lucrative in each one of the different places where you compete?
It is a combination of all of those things, Neil. It really, the most reason why people get into this sport is because they love it. You know, just every pro is an amateur first. So every pro had to work up through the amateur ranks and then get to this level. Usually money, although nice, is not a motivating factor because most people are just not making a living in this sport. Only about, I'm going to say, less than 10% of professional triathletes in the world are actually able to sustain themselves solely on the income that they make either at the races or via sponsorship, which means that they're at the top of their game. They're, you know, doing very well at all the races. But there's someone young like me just getting started. You know, I don't have enough, I don't have a lot of money sponsorship to be able to rely on. So I do work, you know, as well as train for the races. But certainly it's a combo of getting to travel, see all these great places, meet all the amazing people in the sport. They're some of the most highly motivated, overachieving, but also very personable people you could ever meet. And it's just a really fun thing to be around and to compete against yourself even and get to see how you do over time and how you improve. So it's really a combination of all those things. But being pro is nice because you do get a few perks, like being able to sign up for races whenever you want. And you can have the possibility to win prize money, usually through the first 6 or 8 places. They'll usually pay a small amount. It's not a lot, but it's a little bit to cover your fees.
So you're shooting for the Ironman, but you know that there's other opportunities as well. So I guess that once you became doing this, you said, well, I'm going to kind of make this a business in a way because I have to survive. So tell us specifically what your business is all about and how you're able to help others get healthy.
Sure. My business name is Fuel Your Passion. So it's just about fueling whatever it is you want to do with either the right food choices or the right training, just making sure that you're really set up and motivated to achieve your goals, whatever that may be. So I actually started this 4 years ago while I was working a full-time job and training. And at some point, I started to acquire so many clients that I realized it was just impossible to keep all of those balls in the air and do a good job at everything. So finally, last year in the spring, I decided I'm going to go out on my own. I'm going to really make this business work. I'm putting all my effort into it. And it's just been simply amazing. Hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life, but also the most rewarding thing I've ever done working with people from I've worked with people who just want to do a 5K to people who really want to actually do an Ironman, and they're trying to compete to go to Hawaii as an amateur, which they have to qualify as well at an amateur level. So yeah, it's just a really nice way to incorporate everything I believe about life and see these athletes excel and feel better about themselves and make better choices for food and nutrition as well.
Absolutely, Kim, and I think that's a key component, especially with my business partners involved in a health and wellness company, and I am as well. We see the importance, especially with athletes, finding and fueling themselves with the right nutrition and looking for the most important choices to make, because as I work with a two-time Olympian, Siobhan Stoddard, and she talks about how important it is to fuel her body so she's successful in the Olympics and all those things, so I understand completely. But tell me a little bit about the whole thing with MTV Made. That's another interesting storyline.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a real surprise. I actually got back from a business trip when I was working my full-time job about 2.5-3 years ago, and had a message on my answer machine from someone saying they were with MTV at my work number, and they were looking for me. They wanted to talk about doing an interview, and I thought, okay, this is really strange. They've obviously called the wrong person. I don't have any idea if this is a prank call or what's going on. So I end up calling back, and they were looking for a dietitian to work with a young man in Pittsburgh who was going to be on the show. He had interviewed with 300-400 other high school kids, and they had picked his story to be able to show how he wanted to achieve his dream is basically the premise of MTV Made, where, you know, someone is very unlike whatever it is that they want to do, and they really want to branch out and try to do whatever this thing is that's pretty out of reach, and they give them a coach to be able to help them do it. So they have someone guide them through this process, whether they want to become on the cheerleading squad, or in this case, Brandon, who is 16 years old, wanted to do his first triathlon in Pittsburgh in July. And so we would only have about a month to get him ready, a month and a half to get him ready for this particular event that he wanted to do. However, I was just going to be the dietitian, and so they were going to work with me on nutrition counseling for Brandon, and that would be my role. The more that they talked to me, they did have a coach. They already had flown him in. He'd already met Brandon. But they felt like I was a much better fit, and it was just made a lot more sense for me to be working with him. So I ended up taking over the coaching position, but then we only had about 3 weeks left before he'd be standing on the starting line of his first triathlon, where he would be kayaking for 2-mile kayak, a 15-mile bike, and then a 5K, so 3.1 miles. For the run. And so it was just a really, really cool experience, something I'll never forget working with him, and just a great kid that got off the couch from video games and went straight to training for this triathlon and did an awesome job.
Quite interesting, and I think that this experience, I'm sure, helped build your business because it gave you the PR you needed.
Yeah, it was wonderful to get chosen for that. It was a little tough to tell my boss at the time I was going to need an entire month off of work. He wasn't exactly thrilled with the fact that I was going to take a month of unpaid time, but you have to step out on a limb for the things you really believe in, and I knew this was an opportunity of a lifetime to be on this national program and just to get a chance to help someone that I would never get a chance to do so otherwise. I'd never get hooked up with a young man like this. So while I was scared and nervous I was going to do something wrong, or, you know, he wouldn't trust me, I had to break down those barriers of fear and really just go for it in this case. And it was more than worth it to see him cross the finish line. It was just a really amazing experience. And it's still available online too, so anyone can watch it if they'd like to. It's available via my website as well.
Okay, where can our listeners find out more information on you? And please stay on the line after our interview is over, because I want to get some more contact information so we can stay in touch. But where can our listeners find more information on you, follow you, and learn more about you?
Absolutely. They can do that via my website, which is www.fuelyourpassion.net, so .net. And on there, I also have a blog where anyone can follow my journey as I'm traveling to these races and talking about what happens there, where I write a lot of nutrition blogs, a lot of things on different foods to eat or what to avoid. And then I also have my Twitter feed as well, which is the @ Fuel Your Passion. So both those ways are great ways to get in touch.
All right. Well, fantastic. Really enjoyed talking to you. Interesting. Another Pittsburgh person does very well. And I think you're on the right track. And I hope that you can make the Ironman. So thanks again for calling. All right. Take care. You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner in the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. And I'm really excited to welcome the program. And it's going to be a very, very interesting conversation indeed. Rita Giganti, author of The Godfather's Daughter. Rita, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited because, I mean, just to think about your background, think about what you did growing up and how you're saying right now, that's got to be one thing possibly, because being involved in a family like that can kind of be a very challenging thing, couldn't it?
I think challenging is a nice way of putting it. It was quite brutal at some point in the life growing up, but even with all of that, I have to say, coming to where I am today, it was worth every step. And you know, there's still challenges, of course, but, you know, it really has made me the person I am today, all of that, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know?
Well, absolutely. And I think that a lot of times we are shaped through our experiences, and it makes us stronger sometimes, our struggles. But
yes.
Specifically enough, I think that there probably was some fear writing this book, wasn't there? Because I'm sure that people in the family did not want to be recognized or to know about your life in certain ways. Was it hard to go ahead and write those pages?
It was harder for me to have to kind of, for lack of a better way of saying it, throw up the past again, you know, because I healed a lot of the old wounds. But, you know, when you go back over it with a fine-tooth comb the way I did, it does bring up residual pain, anxiety attached to it, things like that. So I have to say that that was the hardest part. The other aspect was, of course, I did not want to disappoint anybody. You know, these are my family members, and I love them dearly. But this was something that I knew I needed to do in order to help myself heal completely, to give the family an opportunity to heal, and also to help, you know, countless people that read the book. Because they'll be able to maybe not identify so much with having a father that was the head of the mafia, but they will identify with the struggles that I've went through and the emotions attached to it, you know.
Well, absolutely.
It was really important for me to get that out there and help as many people as I could.
So let's go at the beginning, because that's why I said we could do more than one segment. Let's go to your childhood. How is it different than other childhoods? Because, again, we don't want to spoil all parts of the book, but we kind of want to capture a thought, especially when I interview a lot of people, I talk about their childhood. How is it different compared to an average family growing
well,
up?
You know, we were shunned from a lot of things. We were protected in a lot of different ways, and not knowing why at that young of an age. But, you know, we had this, you know, this group that we hung with, and meaning, you know, there weren't a lot of outsiders that came in. You know, our family was huge, and my dad's friends and the people that he worked with, they were part of that family, you know. So, and also growing up, you know, my dad didn't live with us. So this was having to travel back and forth, you know, from New Jersey to New York City to visit him was unusual. You know, and then having friends at the age of, you know, 5 years old, 6 years old, saying what their daddy did for a living. And I didn't know what my dad did for a living, so I had to make it up, you know, kind of thing. Not having a family sit down unless it was on a Sunday. family sit-down dinner, unless it was on a Sunday, where other families would be doing that, you know, most nights of the week, because I went to friends' houses and saw this interaction with dads and their kids, and I never understood why, you know, my dad and I only probably exchanged 10 words the whole time in conversation, you know. And plus, I was around a lot of things that I witnessed, you know, as a child with my dad having these men in the house and the whispering that went on and the secrets and the, you know, the lies and all of that. I remember distinctly, you know, the TV being on, the radio being on, and these men would come in and there would be this, my dad never spoke, you know, uttered a word. He would write things on papers, pretty much. And so there would be these papers going back and forth, and you know, this is how they communicated. And then these papers would either be flushed down the toilet or they would be burned up because, you know, they didn't want anybody to read them. But at the age of, you know, 8 or 9, you really don't know. You know something's going on, but you don't know exactly what that is, you know. And I could tell at that age that he was very, he was very well respected. People went to him for things, and, you know, I witnessed that, but I didn't know what that meant,
right,
you know,
exactly.
And actually how powerful he was.
And so when kids were talking, so some kids knew that your father was the godfather then, that knew that the head of the crime family. And then when you first found out, that had to have been a shock to you, right? I mean, you had to question, why is daddy always not around? But there are daddies that work a lot. But also, why are people seeming like my daddy rules the roost everywhere? Not just my mom, not just my other, but everyone that walks in is fearful of my daddy or respecting my daddy like he's a god. When you first found this out, did it floor you, did you have inklings about it?
Well, I gotta tell you, there was a part of me that was like, holy cow. Yeah, I was just like, this is insane. But then there was that piece of me that was relieved, because it was like all the pieces of the puzzle that I couldn't figure out before this kind of snapped right into place, you know? And then it was like, oh, okay, now I understand, you know? And yet I didn't fully understand, you know, because I'm 16 years old. So it's like, you know, some of it you're like, well, how does that really, how far does that really reach? How, you know, he's, wow, the head of all of this, you know, and they have to come to him for permission for things. And there was a part of me that felt protected by that.
Right.
There was a part of me that feared it because I knew that the government could hurt him, and as well as another family that, you know, I didn't know how it all worked, you know. So, sure, there was fear attached to all of that.
By that time when you knew, were you really secretive with your other friends that weren't part of the family, or you were only allowed to interact with cousins and stuff? You weren't allowed to have friends that were outside the family?
No, I was allowed to have friends, and thank God we did move to New Jersey, because that allowed me to be more free with that. But I was like everybody else in the family, very secretive. You know, nobody knew the business or the ins and outs or anything. You know, and nobody even, it's interesting because a lot of my close friends would never dare to ask either. You know, they never asked about my dad or what he did or how he did it or anything like that. So it was interesting. That's how I knew who my real friends were, you know, when they didn't pry like that and want to know all the intimate details. And there was nothing I was going to tell them anyway, but, you know. So.
And were there other crime families around that area so that people were used to this at this time? Or was this something that, like, now because you had the ins and outs, you probably knew about other crime families around your dad's, right?
That were Sure. Yeah, and I mean, the families out here in New Jersey, you know, they were just regular families, I guess. I mean, we all have a dysfunction somewhere in a family, right?
Yes, exactly.
You know, sure. But they were just, you know, regular family, work 9 to 5, you know, got dressed, go to work, and come home and hang with your kids. And, you know, this is not the way it operated in my house. So I was really taken aback by that, but I loved it. I loved going to other people's houses and experiencing a family unit. And then I realized more and more, wow, yeah, we're really dysfunctional here.
So tell me some different things. I guess secretiveness is one of the big things that you can't say where we're going, or you weren't allowed to go out to certain places because you were afraid maybe you would get hurt. I have a story for you, and you wouldn't think this story. My mother-in-law did not grow up in a crime family, but her dad's brother was in a crime family, and so her dad kept her away from doing anything fun, really. She was never allowed to go out. She was never allowed to do any of these certain situations. So that's the other problem, is that you're protected in a way that you're not allowed to go and experience a lot of what other children were able to experience, right?
When I was down there, yes. We were only supposed to go in a certain radius, you know, just a certain block radius. But out in Jersey, it was different because, you know, I had a whole town filled with kids that played outside and, you know, all of that. And it was a lot freer out here. And because my dad didn't live, it was a lot easier, you know. It was a lot easier. Now. And plus, I came way after, like, you know, the child above me is 10 years older than me. It was a whole other, you know, story when I came along. And things weren't as, I would say, as bad. When they were growing up, nobody did anything. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
My brothers and sisters weren't allowed to do anything. Again, they could only go to a certain block, you know, and they weren't allowed past that and all that. But it was a little bit different because I grew up in New Jersey as well, and it gave me a little bit more freedom.
Were you embarrassed when you found out what your father has done to people as Vincent the Chin Gigante? Were you embarrassed in certain ways, or really kind of repentive in certain aspects just because it was your father?
Yeah, I was shocked in a way that, because I didn't see my father that way. Like, I couldn't see him as, giving an order like that. And, you know, and even though his own hands maybe didn't do it, and at some point it might have, it still felt like, oh my God, you know, how could you do something like that? But I struggled with that for a long time, and then I was able to actually see other sides of him, which helped me, help me come to terms with who he was and the fact that he was a human being, and not this thing that people portrayed him to be. And that's when it really helped me, when I started to, you know, almost put myself in his shoes. Like, how would I feel if I were him?
Right.
Having to make decisions on a daily basis, having to look over my shoulder, having never to be able to talk on a phone, never travel, because he only went on his honeymoon and that was it.
Oh, my.
And he lived in a four-room apartment his whole life, you know. Where did he go? He went to a doctor's appointment, or he went, you know, to a meeting or whatever, but... You know, he was like in jail without being in jail.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And did you ever say, why can't you get out of this, Daddy? Why don't we just become normal? Did you ever ask that question to him, or were you fearful of the
No.
No.
I never got that opportunity. No. But
so,
speaking to him now, which you know what I do, right? You know, I'm a medium psychic healer. So this is what I do for a living. And so I can actually speak to my father now.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Been an incredible healing journey with him.
See, I didn't know that part of you. Again, I'm research. I interview about 20 people a week, so don't mind me. I'm more interested in the other, but that's interesting. Okay, so you speak to him now in those ways. And it's being in the same area as that one famous one that's on TLC. Did you ever think you should have a show sometime? What was the meaning?
No, doing reality is not my thing. My passion is really to speak in front of audiences and help people find their own power, be able to speak their truth, learn to forgive, know that they have choice in the life, even if they think that there's no way out, or that, you know, people are going to think badly of them if they make different choices. You know, I had to deal with all that stuff coming out, you know, because I'm gay, so I had to come out to my family as well.
Wow, so there's definitely some difficulties that are in the book that shows your journey to tell,
exactly.
And especially in a crime family, to say that you're gay, you're a psychic. I mean, that's tough.
You're gay, you're a psychic, you're right. And I'm getting married in May, so
congratulations, that's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this has been quite the journey, but but work every step, I have to tell you. And so my, you know, my goal is to be able to help as many people as I can.
Well, and I think you are, and I think that that's the key component. I think the book is just going to shed light on many different things, and it was an honor you're on the show. But like I said, I have so many more questions, so we'll have to bring back in a couple months. I'll talk to your publicist, but you're amazing. Your story is really interesting, and again, the whole psychic thing will be an interesting thing of a story too. So everyone needs to go pick up the book because it goes through a lot of different things leading to where you are today in your healing process. So where can we purchase your book and learn more about you, Rita?
You can go on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's everywhere now at this point. And you can reach me. I have a website just came up, RitaGiganti.com, or Facebook.
All right, Rita, it was a lot of fun, and I guess that you don't have to go in hiding. That's good too, because a lot of crime bosses' families have to hide the rest of their lives. So at least that didn't happen to you. And people have to pick up the book to find out what happened to Vincent in the process and the entire family. And that's what's so interesting about the book. So thanks again for calling, Rita.
Thank you, love. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Okay, bye bye. You're listening to Author's Corner. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. And I go from a crime boss's daughter to an investigative reporter in two segments. Wow. And so many questions I know I'm going to have for Chip Jacobs, the author of Vicodin Thieves. Chip, thanks for calling.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So you're after the crime boss's daughter, but I think that you've seen a lot of crime in your days, haven't you, in your investigations?
Yes, but it tends not to be, yes, both of the white collar as well as the bloody shirt type. Yes, I have seen my share of malfeasance.
So tell us a little bit about your background, then we're going to get to your book, Viking and Thieves.
Sure. Grew up in Pasadena, California. Couldn't really do anything else except for engage my curiosity and became a journalist in the early 90s and worked my way around to every newspaper, those things that people used to read in town, and, found I just liked kind of uncovering mysteries and graft.
Quite interesting. And so you wrote, and when you were an investigative reporter, who did you work for when you were in the investigative reporter?
Well, I think I got really my feet under me doing that for the Los Angeles Times, kind of in the mid-1990s, on an initial story about the state of California slumlord management of hundreds of homes on the path of a future freeway that actually never got built. But their mismanagement, their corruption, you know, in terms of putting their buddies and relatives in these houses, awarding money to sleazy contractors, that type of thing. You know, you really realize the people with the emblem on the paper aren't necessarily any less pure than, you know, the guy behind bars.
Absolutely. So you learn from this process. And I remember having an investigative TV reporter on my show from Boston, and she talked about you really are chasing down and you're really being sneaky, and you're really not liked by a lot of people for being this, right?
That is true. I have been threatened with libel, bodily harm, somebody going to stick a pin in a voodoo doll. Yes, you do have to have a certain amount of backbone. And, you know, we're human, causes anxiety, but I just don't like unsolved mysteries.
No, and so in the process, do you always get like a tip? Is that what happens when you were working for the LA Times? Did they go and say, "Oh, by the way, Chip, we might know. We heard there was a really seedy situation going on with a landlord. You go check it out." Right?
That happens. However, this is my personal experience. I find the best stories are the ones that you never intended to write. The best stories are the ones where you were doing an assigned article and you notice something out of the corner of your eye that makes you start asking questions. And I have gotten innumerable stories out of that. Just by wondering about the history of some structure or an offhand comment somebody made and coming, circling back to that. because, you know, you can chase what everybody else is, but it's kind of those peripheral nuggets that you can make your own.
Definitely. So you're chasing things down, but you find things where you weren't looking. You're investigating one thing and then find something else. Very, very interesting. And by go ahead.
No, I was just gonna one thing. You know, when I was a young reporter, of course, you know, you wanted the big headline, the attention grabber. As I got older and wiser, and I had a lot to grow there, I got more interested in investigating personalities and how people change and the effects of painful experiences on people's evolution. And I really found that I had a interest and hopefully some aptitude on profiling controversial people that were greatly misunderstood in the public eye or, you know, pigeonholed in a certain area. And that fueled me as much as breaking stories about, you know, some sleazy payoff to it by a developer.
Definitely. So very, very interesting. So Chip, why the book now? I guess people told you all your great writings, let's put them all in one collection in one book to interest people. Is that
right? Yes, I had just done a true crime book about a businessman who survived a murder triangle in kind of surreal 1979 Los Angeles. And my publisher looked at my list of stories, you know, that I were highlighting and said, you have more than enough for an anthology. And we put them together. And, you know, they cover everything from stories of speculating mayors to the history of Pasadena's most famous bridge, to a smog emissions trader who got herself involved with Paris CIA people. And so there, it covers the whole rainbow of humanity, and, you know, we put it into a book and let it roll. I also did write two original stories for this book. One was about my older brother's brush with Robert Kennedy, probably hours before he was murdered in 1968. Wow. And he took a couple pictures. I had no idea the story behind these pictures, but it's a pretty stunning 24, 48 hours of Robert Kennedy's life and other people's. And I don't think most outside of wonks understand. So I'm very proud of that. I also did a story about the murder of my own great uncle, who was killed by a man to whom he showed great compassion. This uncle, great uncle, was a early Universal Pictures kind of prodigy, who worked with Carl Laemmle and Irving Thalberg, and just got caught up being too nice to a sociopath.
Wow, interesting. And what people are going to gather from these are they're very short because they're articles mostly that people can pick and choose what they seem the most interested in and look at areas so they can read it cover to cover or they can pick different stories, right?
I would hope so. I mean, of course you want them to read cover to cover, but, you know, I'm not expecting that. Yeah, I mean, I think there is something here for everybody from stories about chili cheese hamburger empire to dumpster diving to chromium 6 contamination to the first U.S. casualty in Operation Desert Storm and even violent bus drivers and KGB in Los Angeles. So, you know, it's I do think it's a buffet. Somebody's going to find something they like.
Okay, let's talk about violent bus drivers. What did you do when you investigated something like that? That's quite interesting.
That one just grew out of a story I read when I was at a newspaper, a little back-to-page story about, I think, about bus drivers getting attacked. And I said, that's interesting, bus violence. This is back when we were starting to build lots of subway and rail in Los Angeles and kind of neglecting the bus service. And I just discovered this whole world of turmoil, violence, retribution, gang warfare on Metropolitan Transportation Authority buses. And my first piece was about bus drivers who get attacked in all types of terrible ways. And that led to the follow-up of bus drivers who don't want to take anything and go on the aggressive. And we're doing some pretty unprofessional, bloody things to passengers, some of whom, you know, provoked them, some of whom did nothing to deserve it. And it did make some news, I have to say. It did get much stepped-up bus security, uniformed guards on buses and things like that. And I'm very proud of it. I don't think I had the bus union sending me Christmas cards, though.
No, not at all. And what you learn from this is that the bus drivers just gave up. They said, I'm tired of this unruliness. I'm going to take care of this.
Yeah, some would bring guns, crowbars, attack developmentally disabled people. You know, this is a very small minority of bus drivers. And I was really startled when a union rep said, you know, we don't always hire the best people. And he just watched me write it down on my notebook.
Oh, that's awful. I just
yes, but you know those buses are a reflection of society, and there's going to be all sorts. And it was kind of interesting. I did ride a bus with the head of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and I swear, on this bus, some gangbangers got on and were kind of eyeing us like we were easy pickings. And so, part of me was thinking, oh, please, you know. Make some commotion, because it's just going to reinforce my assumption that there is a tremendous amount of tumult spilling into those doors.
Definitely. Let's talk about the KGB in L.A. That's an interesting one, right?
Yeah. I wrote this back in the early 90s, actually, at the first newspaper I was lucky to work for. And I had just come out of grad school with a master's in national security. I did want to be a CIA agent, so of course I extended that interest to L.A., and because of the incredible number of aerospace plants we still had here, even after the Cold War ended, and JTLs and universities, we were like a happy hunting ground for the KGB. And, I was very interested to find a lot of these big defense companies like Lockheed, Northrop, Hughes, TRW, they even had sort of counter-spy personnel.
Wow.
You know, that were seeing who's talking to who, protecting classified information. We had a ton of Soviet and Cold War interest here, because this is where we built, you know, our armaments. And they were sort of poaching and sneaking around and trying to get anything they could scoop up. So I did have a lot of fun with that story.
It definitely seems it. And a lot of these are eye-catching. You talked about dumpster diving. You talked about many different things that have happened in your investigations. Have you ever got injured from investigating something?
No, I think I probably developed a small ulcer a few times when people threatening me that they were going to sue me, and a source was wavering about backing me up. Doing a story about, chromium 6 pollution, which is the famous kind of Aaron Brockovich chemical in Burbank in the mid 90s, we revealed that Lockheed had paid about 1,300 people $60 million. In a secret settlement. Well, when we blew the lid on that secrecy, people that were part of this deal were worried that Lockheed was going to take the money back because it was no longer confidential. And they did sort of corner us on a street and threaten bodily harm. And that was not too pleasant. But, you know, the pen is mightier than the sword. So, no, I have not gotten physically injured, though I must say that for a story for the LA Times, I did jump into my own dumpster, and Inspector was in there, and it was not too that was, something where I probably needed a hazmat uniform.
All right, well, Chip, where can people purchase your book and learn more about you? Because I think that's something where they can pick up a certain story and say, here we go, let me go ahead and read this.
Sure, and in terms of the shameless plugging, I will say that I have written three other books, one a biography of my uncle, one this true crime story about an incredible guy named Jerry Snyderman, and then also I co-wrote a book about the social history of the L.A. smog crisis. They can find all that information on my website, chipjacobs.com, and my books are also available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and other online retailers.
All right,
she clicked away.
Fantastic, Chip. Thanks for calling the program. Enjoyed the conversation, and you have a very interesting life. We could go through every one of the stories, but people have to pick up the book to read all the stories. But,
I know. There's always a story behind how you got each one. So, yes, it was my honor to be on, and call me again.
All right, take care, Chip. See ya.
See ya.
Okay,
bye.
All right, you're listening to Author's Corner. We'll be back in just a moment.